A few weeks ago, I found myself in Ypres. We'd had a good day out on the battlefields, and it was night time and I was wandering back through the Groke Market on my own. It was dark, there was hardly anybody about, and then suddenly I stopped and I looked around me and I had a vision in my mind's eye. And suddenly it wasn't 2024. In my mind, I was walking through Ypres, but it was partially destroyed. The cloth hall just behind me was in partial ruins. In my mind's eye, there was hardly anybody about. And then I noticed a limber and gun team hurrying through the Groke Market itself, and it felt ghostly. Then the sound of a shell came screaming over, and I shuddered with fear and anxiety. There was nowhere to hide. It was the closest I'd ever been to the Great War, but this was just in my mind. But it felt like I was really there. Gone were the familiar landmarks that I knew and were so familiar with. The flagpoles, the Eat Burger restaurant, the Leonardis chocolate shop, they'd all disappeared and were replaced by broken buildings in the darkness. The Menstraat seemed to disappear into a black abyss. No longer was the Menin Gate standing at the end of that road in all its glory. I've been to Ypres maybe 100 times over the last 20 years, probably more. I've enjoyed food and wine with so many different people. I've walked back to my modern billet for a good night's sleep with my belly full of Flemish stew and red wine. But this was very different. What sparked this very real dream, I don't know, these thoughts. Perhaps just talking about it on this podcast. But it really did feel as though I'd travelled back in time. Those images haven't drifted away like they do in most dreams, and I can see them now. Maybe it was 1915, the scenes I was seeing in my imagination, and my great uncle Henry and my grandfather would have passed through and seen those scenes that I was imagining. That feeling that I experienced in Ypres last month only lasted a few seconds. And then something happened, I don't know, a car went past or something startled me, something made me realise and brought me back to my senses, and I was back in 2024 and I was heading off back to my nice, comfortable, safe billet. There were no shells screaming overhead. The Menin Gate was still there, although covered in tarpaulin as it undergoes its repairs. And I went back safe, and the next morning I rose, had some breakfast, and we went back out onto the battlefields, but in completely different circumstances to those that I'd imagined the previous night. So welcome to another episode of the podcast that I, Terry Wennan, called Tales from the Battlefields. And it's Ypres and the Menin Gate in particular that I wanted to think and talk about this week, because as anyone who's been to Ypres in the last year or so, I think it's been, and I've noticed that the Menin Gate itself, that splendid memorial, has been covered in tarpaulin. And we can't see the names of those 54,000 missing that Plumer said are no longer missing, they are here. We can't see them, and perhaps if we can't see them, we can't think about them. We can't wonder who those men were that went off, that left their homes from all over the world and didn't go back and didn't even have a grave to remember them by. So what I thought I would do this week was just pick a selection of some of the stories that are beneath that tarpaulin on the Menin Gate. Some of the names that we can't see at the moment, but when we are able to see again, they'll be back. The Menin Gate itself will be back to its former glory. But it's a shame that we can't see them, and we don't want these men to be forgotten, even if it's only temporarily. So as I say, this week, I'm going to pick just a small selection of soldiers that I've talked about when I've stood beneath those enormous arches in Ypres, and I've talked to people about, and I want to share those stories with you today. Some of them are quite well known, some of them are not, but they're still tales from the battlefields. And whilst we're talking about tales from the battlefields, I came across a story this week that is nothing to do with Ypres. It's before Ypres. It's in the Battle of the Aisne in 1914. And I found it in the local newspaper in Northampton when I was looking for something else. This quite often happens, doesn't it? You're looking for something, and then you stumble upon another story and it sticks in your mind. And this short paragraph just said a terrible story of the war. And as I say, it's dated from the autumn of 1914, those first few weeks of the war, after Mons and after the retreat to the Marne, and then we get the race to the sea. And the story says many grim stories of the war have been told by soldiers who returned home from the front, but few can equal in pathos and graphic intensity that of a wounded sergeant, told to one of our representatives at the Northampton barracks. It was during the Battle of the Aisne, which we were defending, said the sergeant. We were fighting hard, and the terrified residents stood on their doorsteps, watching the fight with anguished eyes. German shells were bursting everywhere, tearing up the road before us, and it was a veritable hell. Suddenly, a shell burst before one of the houses, and after the smoke had cleared away, an awful sight met our eyes. A whole family standing there a minute before had been exterminated, with the exception of one little girl of about 9 years old. She was sitting on the step with her right arm blown off and otherwise terribly injured. It was awful. I can see the terrible expression on that poor child's face even now. I was brought to my senses by a voice which yelled at me, "Sergeant, if you don't shoot that kid and put her out of her misery, I will." The voice was that of Paddy Devine, who had vowed that he would get the Victoria Cross like his father did, or die in the attempt. Death has since claimed him. I raised my rifle and I prayed to God for forgiveness for what I was about to do, even though it was for the sake of common humanity. I was, however, saved from the awful necessity of firing, for just as I was about to press the trigger, the child rolled over dead. And I think when we visit the battlefields now, the Somme and Ypres, most of the fighting that we talk about is after the residents, the civilians, have left the area. They fled the area. In Ypres itself, civilians were there until the second Battle of Ypres, the gas attack of April 1915. And then it was left to be the ghost city that I was imagining in my mind's eye that I talked about a few minutes ago. But during those early months, and during the latter months, I suppose, the latter weeks, the 100-day offensive, the civilians were just as much victims of the Great War as what the soldiers were. And that awful story, I wonder who that family were. We'll never know who that family were. Do they have a memorial? Do they have a grave? Do people still remember them? We don't know who they were, but I've just told their story, so we'll remember them today. So before we start looking at the individual stories, let's go back to the opening of the Menin Gate on Sunday the 24th of July 1927. There was a long procession of relatives of the dead wound its way through the Grote Market to the Menin Gate itself, and they took their places on the eastern side of the gate where the bridge is. Following on from the town hall, the official dignitaries included the King of the Belgians, Albert, Field Marshal Plumer himself, and the French General Foch. Hundreds of local inhabitants, veterans and relatives of the fallen were gathered in the Grote Market and along the route itself to the Menin Gate. Along the roadway which crosses the moat at the eastern entrance, there was seating facing the memorial for about 160 official guests and military representatives. And there were brass bands, military bands from both Britain and Belgium. And there was a wooden platform for those given speeches was positioned just in front of the eastern arch of the memorial. And veterans of the Great War, some of them wearing civilian clothes and carrying wreaths, were gathered on the pavement under the memorial's central arch, just as people do now or will do when the memorial's open again. Crowds were standing up on the ramparts on either side of the memorial and along the road opposite the memorial on the eastern side of the moat. And from the windows of the buildings, these newly built houses overlooking the memorial, people were hanging out so they could see what was going on and hear what was happening. Loudspeakers were set up so that everybody could hear the ceremony, and millions were also listening to the ceremony, which was being broadcast by wireless by the BBC over in Britain. Now, the centrepiece of the opening was, of course, Lord Plumer, Daddy Plumer, I mentioned him earlier. It was his job to officially unveil the memorial. He was standing on the spot where countless British soldiers had passed through that gateway on their last march to the front line. And here we've got evidence that 54,000 of them had not returned. Plumer himself had witnessed the town of Ypres being smashed to pieces. And this is just a section of what Lord Plumer said in his speech. The idea was to give comfort to the parents and relatives that were watching or listening. He said one of the most tragic features of the Great War was the number of casualties reported as missing, believed killed. To their relatives, there must be added to their grief a tinge of bitterness and a feeling that everything possible had not been done to recover their loved ones' bodies and give them the reverent burial. That feeling no longer exists. It ceased to exist when the conditions under which the fighting was being carried out were realised. But when peace came and the last ray of hope had been extinguished, the void seemed deeper and the outlook more forlorn for those who had no grave to visit, no place where they could lay tokens of loving remembrance. It was resolved that here at Ypres, where so many of the missing are known to have fallen, that there should be erected a memorial worthy of them, which should give expression to the nation's gratitude for their sacrifice and its sympathy with those who mourn them. A memorial has been erected, which, in its simple grandeur, fulfills this object, and now it can be said of each one in whose honour we are assembled here today, he is not missing, he is here. And then at the end of the service, buglers of the Somerset Light Infantry sounded the last post, and pipers of the Scots Guards standing on the ramparts played a lament. To be there on that hot summer's day in July 1927 must have been quite an experience, especially for those veterans and relatives who were thinking of those dead that Plumer himself was talking about. So now, using your imagination, let's walk under the Menin Gate. Let's look at some of those soldier stories, some of those incredible stories that we talk about when we're there. And the first one I want to talk about is a Canadian man. And his name was Lieutenant Lawrence Browning Rogers and was serving with the 5th Canadian Mounted Rifles Battalion. He was 40 years old when he died on the 30th of October 1917 in the Third Battle of Ypres, the Battle of Passchendaele as we call it, and he's remembered on panel 30. And he had a 10-year-old daughter called Aileen. He lived in Quebec and she seemed to understand that her dad was going to be lonely and was going to miss her and also his son Howard. So she gave him a teddy bear. It was her favourite stuffed bear and she hoped that it would bring him good luck and keep her daddy company. Rogers kept the teddy with him for more than 2 years. It was a cherished connection to his family back home. In 1916 he wrote a letter to his wife and he said, "Tell Aileen I still have the teddy bear and will try and hang on to it for her. It's dirty and its hind legs are kind of loose, but it's still with me." I mentioned his son Howard, he also missed his father, and he wrote a letter on September the 8th, 1917, but it never reached his father because Rogers died before he had a chance to read it. But that letter said, "Dear Daddy, we have had holidays ever since the 3rd, and I've played all the time and I've got to go back tomorrow morning. I went to the movies twice. A little boy just came to the door selling tickets for some movies, 5 cents, but we would not take one. I try my hardest at school to come first. I joined the YMCA and have been there twice at gym. I haven't had a swim yet. I will have to close because I'm burning up all the electric light." And when he died, his comrades buried his body, which was later lost, and they found that tiny stuffed bear tucked away in his pocket. And it was returned. Somehow that teddy got returned to the family back home in Quebec. And that bear is now on display in the Canadian War Museum. And that letter from his son Howard is beside it. Both are powerful connections to the First World War. They symbolise that many families who were separated from their loved ones at times of war, they went to every effort they could to keep in contact with their loved ones and send out keepsakes like Teddy. And if you do get a chance to go to the Canadian War Museum and you'll see Aileen's teddy bear, her dad told her that the legs were loose, the hind legs were loose, and they were lost. The teddy's still there, his arms are there, but he hasn't got any legs. Now all of these men that are remembered and everybody that died in the war We talk about them and we think about what would have happened to them, what would they have achieved in their lives had they managed to survive the Great War. So many of them had got academic qualifications, academic achievements, some of them had been in business, and many of them, of course, had sporting achievements. Now, just listen to this one. On panel 9, you'll find the name of Captain A. E.J. Collins from the 5th Field Company of the Royal Engineers, and he was killed on the 11th of November 1914 during the First Battle of Ypres. And I'm looking at a photograph of him now as a 13-year-old pupil at Clifton College in Bristol. And he's wearing his cricket whites. He's got his pads on that look discoloured, even in a black and white photo. And in his left hand, he's holding a bat, a cricket bat. A bat much smaller than the bats they use now, but it still looks quite big against his slight frame. Just 13 he was, when one day in June 1899, he went out to bat in an inter-house match. And he scored an incredible 628 runs, not out. It was the highest individual total ever recorded in a cricket match at that time, and his record stood for 117 years. So I often show his photograph and tell his story, but for this podcast I decided to have a little bit more detail about it, look for some more details. And on the Imperial War Graves Commission website, under their collections, there's a newspaper article about us that tells us much more about this young man. It tells us that he was born in India and that the match that he scored, his incredible total, was between Clark's House and North Town. But that wasn't all. When he was in senior school, he was in the first cricket 11, the first rugby football 15, and he represented his school in boxing, featherweight boxing, at the public schools competition in Aldershot. He was head of the house at the age of 17. Then he went to Woolwich, and he took fourth place in a list of successful candidates. This was the officer training corps, no doubt. It doesn't say that, but that's what it would have been. He joined the Royal Engineers in December 1904, and at the age of 21 went to India, and he was stationed there till 1914. And when he was in India, he played polo, rackets and tennis. And on returning to England, he took up cricket again. He played for the Royal Engineers at Aldershot, and he played at Lord's against the Royal Artillery. And then in August 1914, he went out to Belgium with the Royal Engineers. And on the 11th of November, his company was called up to help thrust the enemy back at Polygon Wood. And it was while signalling for reinforcements during this action that he was killed. He was mentioned in dispatches by Sir John French on the 14th of January 1915 and was gazetted as a captain after his death. Captain Collins was a member of the Junior Army and Navy Club. He was married in April of 1914 to a lady called Ethel, and he was 29 years old when he was killed in those first few weeks of the war. Obviously, he has no known grave, but he's not forgotten, and his name is also listed not just on the Menin Gate, but on the memorial at Bath College. Now, let's look at the tale of a couple of, or three brothers. On panel 6, you have to look quite high up on that panel, but when you do, you'll find the entries for the Royal Fusiliers. And there's an unusual name of Rachel, and that's spelled R-A-C-H-E-I-L. A, F, and another F. That's Arthur, born in 1894, Frank, 1897, and Frederick, in 1891, and in 1911, the family was living in East Ham, London, which makes sense that they joined the Royal Fusiliers. They served in the 3rd Battalion. On the 24th of May 1915, during that Second Battle of Ypres, the battalion was in trenches near Hoog up on the Menin Road, and they were attacked by the Germans with poison gas, heavy artillery, and then a determined infantry attack. The battalion's war diary, there's a report from Major Baker. He was the sole surviving officer from that attack. And he said that from 8 o'clock onwards, I was the only officer survivor. Out of a total of 880 rank and file, some 70 men were collected in a gas condition in the rear of the line, and some 150 men remained ultimately with me. The remainder were killed, wounded, or missing. I make that over 500 casualties. And unfortunately, Arthur, Frank, and Frederick all died in that maelstrom. None of them have a known grave, which is why their names are etched on the walls of panel 6 on the Menin Gate. I wonder if they are out there buried somewhere, and if they are, let's hope they're together. Just imagine what that scene must have been like for their mum when she received not one but three messages saying that all three of her boys had died, and worst of all, they had no known grave. Absolutely unimaginable, isn't it? On the same panel, again quite high up, you'll see the entry of Lieutenant Aidan Chavasse from the King's Liverpool Regiment. Now, this is the brother of the famous Noel Chavasse, who was awarded the Victoria Cross twice. But the story of Aidan is even more tragic. On the 4th of July 1917, just after midnight, he was sent out on a patrol to do a recce on the German lines opposite. This was in preparation for the forthcoming 3rd Battle of Passchendaele, which started, 3 weeks later, 2.5 weeks later? Unfortunately, they were met by an enemy patrol coming in the opposite direction. It was a fierce firefight. Aidan's party withdrew, and he was bringing up the rear to make sure that his lads got back safely. But when they got back to their own trenches, they realised he was missing. No one had noticed. He was so popular amongst his men that they went back to search for him. Second Lieutenant Peters and a Lance Corporal Dixon found him in a shell hole close to the enemy lines, and he was wounded in the thigh and he couldn't walk. Peters went off to try and find some help, but he was killed. So Dixon bandaged his wounds, and then he also went off in search of help. But now darkness had turned to morning light. It was midsummer. Dawn came very early. It was too dangerous for anyone to go back into no man's land, and the second rescue attempt had to wait until the following evening. And then they went out again that night, but they couldn't find him. They didn't give up. They tried several further searches, and they presumed he'd been taken prisoner and taken back into the German trenches. His family were informed that he was missing. They thought he'd been captured. They still held out hope that Aidan was just wounded and would be returned to them after the war. But as in so many cases, there was nothing ever heard of him. He was never found, and he didn't return home. His mother, Edith, doted on him, and she dreamed of him, she said, every anniversary of his death. She imagined in her mind's eye of him crying out for her in no man's land, and maybe that's what happened. But exactly 10 years after his death, on the 4th of July 1927, she died too. Was that a very sad coincidence? I'll leave you to decide. I don't know. This next story is also talking about two brothers, literally brothers in arms. And they were Private 7425 James Stallard and Private 8303 John William Stallard, who were serving with the 2nd Battalion as the Oxford and Buckinghamshire Light Infantry. James Stallard joined the Oxfordshire Light Infantry around 1905, and in August 1914 he was called up from the reserve, by which time he was working as a carpenter in Northampton, and he had a wife and a baby daughter. His brother joined the Oxford and Bucks Light Infantry in 1910, and he was also called up from the reserves. And they landed in Boulogne on the 14th of August 1914, and James wrote home to his parents, and some of these letters were published in the local newspaper, the Wolverton Express. This one is dated the 24th of September 1914, just a few weeks into the war, and you can see how they felt about it. I beg for the finish of this war, and it is war. Hell cannot be worse. It's just like waiting for death. But still, we are lucky enough to escape so far, and can safely say it's a game of luck, and trust luck will be with us to the end. Whoever is spared will have thoughts and memories of war, the like of which have never been seen before in history. One has only to think of the countries involved, the up-to-date guns we have all in action, and the range and power of the weapons in use, and try and form opinions of the result. We are not against a lot of farmers, but against a nation of fighting material. One of the most touching events I've seen in this war was in Belgium, in our advance and retirement on and from Mons. There we saw the most unfortunate people leaving what had once been their homes with a bit of food all tied up in anything they could carry, aged, young and babies, all destitute. We met them in the woods, in the fields, and in fact everywhere we went we found the poor, terrified folk. It was heart-rending. At one large house, as we advanced on Mons, the family were just leaving, and with eyes much swollen by crying, one young girl, about 22 or 23, unable to hold herself in check, ran forward at the sight of our troops, and before we were aware of her intentions, had kissed several of us on both cheeks. That sort of thing tends to touch even the hardest of hearts. The people of Belgium behaved to us splendidly. Never to my dying day shall I forget their kindness. A few weeks later, James wrote again to his parents. He said, "It's the coal boxes or Jack Johnson's that worry us. It's bad enough to hear them screaming over us through the air, but it's like being in hell to get them bursting in front or anywhere near us. Their terrific noise, shake, smoke, and the waiting for them to drop as one hears them coming is a thing I cannot explain. It is awful waiting to hear and feel the explosion so as to be able to breathe once again freely and wait for the scream of the next one. They leave a hole large enough to bury a horse. Never did I dream that any of the different sort of things to be done by a European race that has been done here, the hundreds of thousands of homes in Belgium and France that have been purposely robbed and ruined, is a disgrace to any nation. It's an awful sad sight for us to see as we came through the villages and towns. But what in heaven's name must have been thoughts of the French Tommy? The Germans were left strewn all up in the roads and in the hedges, also the woods. Some were ghastly." On the 11th of November 1914, a date that we've already talked about, a date that crops up so many times in 1914, the battalion that they were serving with found themselves on the Menin Road, just to the north of the Menin Road, on the Westhope Ridge. And they were involved in a violent encounter with the Germans that were attacking down the road there. And what we know about what happened that day was recorded by the 2nd Battalion's commanding officer, Lieutenant Colonel H.R. Davis. He recalled the events in great detail, and there's just one section here that I want to read you now. He says, "So we went on again, and I actually forgot my wound for a time. I heard a ghastly noise coming from the right, and taking a plunge into some undergrowth, I came upon a little man in khaki, cursing and swearing and crying all at once and making the most agonising noises. He was trying to get his bayonet out of a large Boche. I gathered that the Boche had surrendered, and he had then picked up his rifle and tried to shoot his captor, who was so frightened that he shoved his bayonet right into the bony part of the Boche, and then got still more frightened when he found he couldn't get his bayonet out again. He was simply howling with rage and fright and tugging like a maniac. I told him to leave his bayonet where it was and take the German rifle and bayonet and pick up another English one when he could find one." I wonder what on earth happened to that poor German lad. This is what goes on in war, isn't it? But sadly, during that day, serving together, James and John Stallard had been killed. The news of their death reached Wolverton, their hometown, which is near Milton Keynes, on Christmas Day of 1914. And one of the articles that appeared gave us a little bit more information about what actually happened to them. And it says, "A fatal call. A brother's call proved fatal to Private J.F. Stallard, who was killed in action on the 11th. He was in a trench during a German attack when he heard his brother call to him. He got up to go to him, but fell down riddled with bullets. He leaves a widow and infant." His brother's death was reported in the Northampton local paper where he'd been living with his wife in Grafton Street. She said that the last she'd heard from her husband was in a letter written by him on the 10th of November, the day before his death, and that he was the brother to Private John Stallard of the same regiment, a well-known boxer who was in training for an important competition at the date of mobilisation, and he's also unofficially reported killed. James was 28, Jack or John was 26, and they're remembered on panel 39. I haven't seen their names yet because I only just discovered this story the other day in our local library in Northampton. But as soon as the Menin Gate is open again, I'll be going to find their names and telling their story to the people that I take with me. On the 31st of July 2017, I was very fortunate to be at the Menin Gate when it was the 100th anniversary of the Battle of Passchendaele, the Third Battle of Ypres. And there was some words spoken that day by Prince William that I'd just like to play to you now. It really does bring it home to you, the true enormous significance of the Menin Gate and the men that are remembered there.
Every evening, the city of Ypres falls silent at 8 o'clock, and the last post is played by the buglers of the Last Post Association. With the sounding of this bugle call, the 250,000 British and Commonwealth soldiers who were killed on the Ypres salient during the First World War are remembered. The battlefields of the salient came to define the war for many British and Commonwealth soldiers. The defence of the city at such great cost meant that it became hallowed ground. Winston Churchill said of Ypres, "A more sacred place for the British race does not exist in all the world." It was from here, along the Menin Road, that so many marched towards the front line. After the war, when a location was being sought for a lasting memorial to these men, it seemed fitting for it to be built by the Commonwealth War Graves Commission in this place. Today, the Menin Gate records almost 54,000 names of the men who did not return home. The missing with no known grave. Members of our families, our regiments, our nations, all sacrificed everything for the lives we live today. During the First World War, Britain and Belgium stood shoulder to shoulder. 100 years on, we still stand together, gathering as so many do every night in remembrance of that sacrifice. Thank you for the honour that you do us.
Wonderful words there that I was, as I say, so privileged to hear live. What's next now? Getting on for 7 years ago, isn't it? And what the now Prince of Wales is talking about there is that bond of friendship between Britain and Belgium, and that's personified every evening when the Last Post Association play, the buglers play the Last Post. It's all about friendship and commemoration between our two countries. And talking of the Last Post Association, Prince William was then followed by a member of the association who also spoke with such lovely words and gave a view from a Belgian perspective.
Every time we stand here under the Menin Gate, we feel overwhelmed by the immensity of the sacrifice of the men whose names surround us. And when a fresh breeze whispers through the arches, it touches something inside all of us. It is as if the fallen were telling us, "We did this for you." Indeed, they came to our country from near and far to defend our freedom alongside our own soldiers. Ever since, we have expressed our gratitude to these heroes, and 100 years have passed without it being diminished. I am proud of the people of Ypres and of other places on the Western Front, conscious of the sacrifices made by those who fought on Belgian soil. They pay homage daily on behalf of all Belgian citizens. The last post ceremony held here each evening is a tradition founded and maintained by the local community. It has taken place more than 30,000 times since 1928 and is an important part of the identity of the city of Ypres. Members of the Last Post Association organized the ceremony day after day on busy summer evenings and quiet winter nights. For your dedication, we thank you.
We can all echo those words, can't we, whenever we've stood there at the Menin Gate. I've been to it, I don't know, well over 100 times, I suppose. I don't know, I haven't kept count. But it still has the same effect on me now as it did the first time I went there in 1980. I went there with my dad, took me there. It still has the same, brings me out in goosebumps, really. It does now, just listening to those words and just thinking about it. And as long as that feeling is maintained, then we'll keep returning to the Menin Gate, won't we, and taking people along so that they can share those special feelings. Feelings and emotions that have been created by the Belgian people. And then if you go to panel 10 on the Menin Gate and look up, you'll see the name of Lieutenant Alexis Helmer of the 2nd Battery of Canadian Field Artillery. And his friend was a man called John McCrae, a medic with the Canadians. On the day that Helmer was killed by a shell, McCrae wrote these words: "Sunday, May the 2nd, 1915. Heavy gunfire again this morning. Lieutenant Helmer was killed at the guns. His diary's last words were, 'It has quieted a little and I shall try to get a good sleep.' His girl's picture had a hole through it and reburied it with him. I said the committal service over him as well as I could from memory. A soldier's death. Battery fires again registering barrages or barrages of fire at set ranges. At 3 the Germans attacked, preceded by gas clouds. Fighting went on for an hour and a half, during which their guns hammered heavily, with some loss to us. The French lines are very uneasy." An eyewitness to his death, a Lieutenant Bick, said that Helmer had just finished the operation of digging when a solitary Jack Johnson shell fell almost at his feet and exploded. He was literally blown to pieces. And these words that were written by Bombardier Cyril Allinson, who was serving with John McCrae, give us a clue as to the ultimately famous circumstances and the reason why I'm telling Alexis' story today. This is what he said. "On the afternoon of Sunday, May the 2nd, Lieutenant Alex Helmer had left his bunk. En route, an 8-inch lands on top of him, blowing into pieces. As soon as the strafing stops, a couple of his men go to the burial ground and dig the grave. The others go around the area, picking up as many pieces as they can find to put into sandbags, which are then laid into an army blanket in the form of a body. A small group gathered together and John McCrae recites part of the burial service that we were all familiar with. 'I am the resurrection and the life.' John McCrae was terribly moved. Alex had been one of his close friends. Shortly after that, he went and sat on an ambulance looking at the grave, and then he wrote the original version of In Flanders Fields.
In Flanders Fields, the poppies blow between the crosses, row on row that mark our place. And in the sky, the larks still bravely singing fly, scarce heard amid the guns below. We are the dead. Short days ago we lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow, loved and were loved, and now we lie in Flanders fields. Take up our quarrel with the foe. To you from failing hands we throw the torch. Be yours to hold it high. If ye break faith with us who die, we shall not sleep, though poppies grow in Flanders field.
A poem beautifully read there, famous poem, probably one of the most famous of all, beautifully read there by Dame Helen Mirren in the Grote Market at Ypres, in that same ceremony to commemorate the centenary of Passchendaele in July 2017. And what happened next was that apparently McRae threw the piece of paper away. Somebody retrieved it. A few months later, it was published in the Punch magazine. And now it's always associated with World War I and Ypres in particular. The story goes that later, poor Alex Helmer's body was blown up again. So he was blown up twice, once in life and once in death. His grave was lost forever, and he's now remembered, like all those others, on the Menin Gate. We learn a bit more about Alex Helmer when we look at the words that were written about him by his commanding officer, who said, "We've been through a very severe battle, which started about 5 p.m. on the 22nd of April. Doubtless you've already heard through the department of your loss, which is ours as well. During the strenuous fighting from the 22nd of April to the 2nd of May, Lex was in the middle of it, doing his duty in a most gallant and conscientious manner. It seems hard that on the 1st of May I sent his name in for gallantry whilst being under fire on the 27th of April, and also for his conduct on the 24th when he was acting as a forward observation officer for the battery. And he was driven back by the poisonous fumes of the Germans, but still stuck to his post until I ordered him in. He was badly poisoned by the fumes, but begged and begged not to be sent to hospital, and after a period of 24 hours was once more in full charge of his section. He was full of pluck, and he fought his guns time and time again to a finish, at times when we all thought we were cut off and would never get through. His men adored him, and his section simply went to pieces when they saw what had happened. On the night of the 1st and 2nd of May, we changed the position of Lex's section. One of my last recollections of him was on the afternoon of the 1st of May, when I saw him standing in the middle of his section doing his job with shells falling all around. I was passing about 50 yards away, and he waved his hand and smiled. He was always in the best of spirits and kept his men in fine shape. If I may say so, the battery has suffered a loss which cannot be remedied. Captain Cosgrave, who was at the Royal Military College and McGill with Lex, was near at hand when the shell came in and immediately took charge of everything." Alex Helmer was 22 years old. This next story is really quite incredible. As you come up from the town itself, the first panel you see, 1A on the right hand side, contains lots of names from India. And it's one of those that I want to talk about now. A man called Jamada Kapoor Singh. He was serving with the 57th Wild Rifles. And his story dates from the First Battle of Ypres in October of 1914, the 31st of October 1914. One of those dates, a bit like the 11th of November, that keeps cropping up time and time in our stories. His company was called a Dogra Company. And these were tribesmen from the remote hills between the Punjab and Kashmir on India's northwest frontier. These were men that were known to their commanding officers in the British Army as being of good behaviour, courtly manners, high courage and physical endurance. And we're about to see an amazing example of that. On that day, the 31st of October 1914, up on the Messines Ridge, they were in the way of the German 26th Division, which unleashed an attack against the British and the Indians that were holding the ridge. In the morning mist, three battalions of the Germans bore down on the waiting Dogras. They were advancing apparently at a jog trot and making racious, guttural sounds. Most of the British officers had been killed in the ensuing hand-to-hand fighting, and at command eventually devolved upon the sole survivor, a man called Lieutenant Maloney. And he withdrew the rifles to a shallow trench. These were, at this stage, of course, in the war, there were no formal structured trenches. They were yet to come. And this was just a shallow foxhole, I suppose, along a hedge line. And here they engaged the Germans in a ferocious firefight. This lasted more than 2 hours. But at 6 o'clock in the morning, Maloney was badly wounded in the arm. And his men decided to evacuate him whilst it was still dark. But before he left, Maloney gave strict instructions to the two surviving Indian officers that they should under no circumstances retire, unless the British, on their flank, should do so first. They should only follow the British. This was the ethos, this was the rule at the time. So with these orders ringing in their ears, these two officers, Sir Ram Singh and our man Kapoor Singh, returned to the trenches to renew the fight with their German enemy that had many more men than them. The British on their flanks were under less pressure. They didn't withdraw. So the Indians felt honour-bound to remain in their exposed and what was a hopeless position, really. One by one, the men were picked off and there was just Kapoor Singh that was remaining. Everyone else had been killed or wounded. But the Germans, they still couldn't take his position. By 8 o'clock, the brave Jamada was down to his last bullet. Now, what would you do? What would most men do? Well, they'd have surrendered, wouldn't they, and hoped that the Germans would look after them. Kapoor had got no men, he'd got no ammunition apart from one bullet. He'd done as well as he could. He was 26 years old and a Hindu. As the Germans closed in on him, he took his rifle, he put his final bullet into his own brain. The Menin Gate that we've talked about so much in this last hour or so very nearly didn't happen. No other than Winston Churchill wanted to preserve the ruins of Ypres as a memorial. And he was quoted as saying, "I should like to acquire the whole of the ruins of Ypres. A more sacred place for the British race does not exist in the world." But that suggestion didn't go down very well with Fabian Ware, the creator of the Imperial War Graves Commission. Neither was it to go down well with the people of Ypres or the Belgian government. On the 30th of January 1919, the Times reported that, and I quote, "Ypres is to remain unrestored as a memorial of what Belgium has suffered in the war. The decision is so right that it seems to be what we've always expected. Another Ypres will rise near the old one, representing the future for the freedom and security of which the past has paid so great a price. These ruins will mean more than the most splendid monument. They will mean a courage lasting through despair into triumph." But there was no way this was going to happen. The people of Ypres were already returning and they were living in temporary buildings whilst their old homes were rebuilt, their businesses were rebuilt on the site of their old ones. This was never going to happen, and I think, hopefully you'll agree that all these years later, that we've still got the old Ypres to go and see, to go and enjoy the cafes and the hospitality and the museums, to go and see that wonderful Menin Gate, with all those stories on the walls of the Menin Gate. The memorial that was designed by one of the leading architects of so many of the cemeteries of the Imperial War Graves Commission, Sir Reginald Blomfield. He designed hundreds of the cemeteries on the battlefields, but it's said that the Menin Gate was the only one that he was entirely satisfied with, and when you stand back now and look at it in all its glory, you can see exactly what he meant. But there's another irony which I always think about when I stand there looking at the Menin Gate. You see people standing there on the Ypres side, on the town side, taking photos of it and the words that are created by Rudyard Kipling, as words say, to the armies of the British Empire who stood here from 1914 to 1918 and to those of their dead who have no known grave. So what is that irony that I talk about? Well, it's the fact that however large the gate was, it wasn't big enough. It commemorates those that died in the Ypres salient between the 4th of August 1914 and August of 1917, just after the start of the Battle of Passchendaele, with the run-out of space. They needed, at that time, almost another 35,000 spaces. There was no room. And that's why when you go up to Passchendaele, you go up to Tynecot, you take in the enormity of the 12,000 graves there, and then you see the circular wall along the back, and you find those other almost 35,000, 34,500 names now of the men that died on those battlefields, not just in 1915 or 1917, throughout the war. They're out there somewhere, those men, but wherever they are, as Pluma said, they are no longer missing. They are here. And to end the podcast this week, thank you again for tuning in, listening to my words, my rambles, and remember all of those men that were lost on those muddy fields, the farmlands of Ypres and Passchendaele, of the Messines Ridge, of the Pilcombe Ridge. We remember all of them, we do, by the playing of The Last Post, which has been played, as we said, well over 30,000 times every night at the Menin Gate.